We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft is at the controls. And we're also happy to have here on the program, once again with us, Dr. Malcolm Hill. He is a pediatrician from Carl in Urbana. Occasionally he's here and we talk about children's health. There are a few things that we have in mind that we can talk about, but the idea of having him here is for him to be a resource for you. So if you have questions about children, your kids, grandkids, whatever the children are in your life, the kinds of things that you can imagine talking about with the pediatrician, well, call us and talk with Dr. Hill, and he will do his best to help you out. As I always try to say when we have physicians here on the program, we can't do diagnosis over the telephone. There are some limitations on what we can do, but we do these shows to hopefully provide you some information and give you a place to start. And then, of course, you got real concerns. You need to pursue that with your own physician or somebody who can see the child in question. But this is a place that you can start by calling in 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you would like to send us an email, well, you can do that too. You can write to will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, that's the address, at illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning.
Appreciate it. I know there are a number of things we could talk about, and there are a couple of events I think that you would maybe like to mention, and because one of them is coming up pretty soon here, actually, I think it's tomorrow. Right? Why don't we mention that? And this is has to do with food allergies.
Yes, thank you very much. As probably people are aware, food allergies are a big deal now.
Yeah.
Trouble at home, trouble at school. It's a difficult subject. Some new guidelines came out a couple of months ago to guide the physicians in terms of diagnosis and treatment because there's a lot of misinformation out there. We're all trying to get up to speed. So what we did was we are partnering with Children's Memorial in Chicago to help us develop a food allergy program, and we're having a community event this Friday from 4:30 to 7 at the Forum at Carl. And it starts at 4:30 with allergy plans for school, and that would probably be a pertinent for teachers, school nurses. We have a second session, food allergies, and children under 5. There'll be parenting tips. It's very difficult to deal with kids with food allergies under 5 because they're going to forage and get into all sorts of things. So it becomes a real nightmare for parents with significant food allergies. Food allergies are... people think they're kind of annoyance, but they can be very serious, and kids can react very quickly and die very suddenly. So we take food allergies pretty seriously, I think, especially for some of the more common food allergies like nuts and peanuts. You'll probably hear about that.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a session keeping food safe at school, and then basics on diagnosis and things. So it's going to be a fun evening. If you have family or friends or children with food allergies, I think it'd be really fun to attend. It would be helpful to register at 326-0180, which is at the Carl Foundation. So if you get a chance, attend. It'd be funny. It'd be fun, and you'll learn a lot. The speaker's going to be from Children's Memorial, and she's excellent. Her name is Christine.
Mm-hmm.
She's talked to the doctors before. So.
Okay. So this is tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
At the Forum at Carl in Urbana, starting at 4:30 in the afternoon.
Yes.
All right. Sounds good. This is one of these things that I'm sure that really bedevils parents because you can, as you say, well, you can have very serious symptoms like anaphylactic shock. Someone can actually die.
Yes.
But then you can also have kids who have a lot of gastric problems and, you know, things where, and I'm sure there the parents are kind of wondering, well, what is it? So it can be very difficult, first of all, just to figure out what the problem is and then how to deal with it. And I'm sure that one of the big questions parents always ask is there any chance my child is going to grow out of this, or is this going to be some sort of a lifelong problem?
Yeah. Well, the diagnosis can be difficult because when you look at food allergies, there's multiple symptoms that can occur You know, you might have one or many. And I think the most common symptoms were obviously hives, swelling of the mouth, tongue, throat. You can have some vomiting and diarrhea. And these, for true food allergy, we're talking about a specific reaction caused by an antibody called IgE, as opposed to just intolerance to a food. If I eat Chinese food, maybe I go home and have some problems with digestion, or you might have heartburn, or you might have some diarrhea with certain food. But true food allergies are pretty much happen every time you eat the food. They're fairly significant reactions. So they're not just minor intolerances like lactose intolerance. And so the problem is that if you react mildly the first time, that might not be true the second time. The second time might be life-threatening. So it's very difficult to tell people that it's a minor reaction when the next time around, if you eat something, it might be a major reaction. So avoidance is really very important, and that's why a lot of these sessions are going to talk about avoidance. If you do have an accident and end up ingesting an item that you're allergic to, then you need to be prepared to take action. And that's the other part of the other side of the coin is if you do have something happen, you need to be prepared. And so that's epinephrine is really the treatment of choice in these self-administered type of EpiPens. And I think really that's a big topic. Know how to use the EpiPen, know when to use it, have a formal action plan. We're talking about action plans now at school and at home so that parents and teachers and everyone know what to do, and there's no question about it, and it's written. And I think that's where we're going to with more formal action plan. One of the parents that really got this started in town, our food allergy program, went into the school and just found that they really weren't prepared to take care of an emergency. And so she worked with the school very, very much one-on-one and got that school in line. And we're hoping that this is where the program will go. Yeah.
Do schools still have school nurses?
Some of them do, but most of the time there's not a school nurse on site. So it requires someone else with maybe without medical knowledge to be there and to administer the EpiPen to, you know, prevent the major reactions from proceeding. Because early, they found that early administration of epinephrine with a food allergy reaction is critical. If you wait too long, then actually it's kind of like a cascade or a snowball effect, and then it often leads to more serious problems. Mm-hmm. So really, I think that's another important point too. But the most common food allergens that we run into are tree nuts and peanuts, milk, eggs, soy, and shellfish. And you mentioned outgrowing. Some kids do outgrow some of the food allergies, but typically the nuts and peanuts, they don't, which is a bad deal.
Yeah. All right. Questions are certainly welcome on this or anything else here that has to do with children's health. Our guest is pediatrician Dr. Malcolm Hill. And if you want to call in and talk with him, whatever your concern is, please do give us a call. And I know he'll do his best to help you out. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for a second to stay with food, I'm sure that for a long time now, parents have been concerned about food, particularly packaged, manufactured foods, not just what they're preparing, but what's available out there in the world and what's in it. And I'm sure that people are concerned about various kinds of things that are added to the food. It seems to me just recently, again, we're seeing some articles about colorings, the food colorings that are added to food and whether or not they are an issue. And it seems that there has always been some kind of back and forth, like we're really not completely sure what sort of effect things like that, like a food coloring or something that's added as a preservative. You know, you look now at food labels and you see these things, and even if you're experienced in chemistry, you might say, well, what is all of this stuff? What really do we know about the food additives and their effect on children?
Not much. I think, you know, there was some research done quite a while ago on ADD and food additives and dyes and things of this sort. And actually it turned out that a small percentage of kids, like 2%, had some physical reaction to yellow dye. But it's not typical to really find symptoms related to these products. We just don't know. I think, you know, generally, if you look at the way we're going, most things that are packaged with a lot of dye in them are sweet, sugary things that you probably wouldn't want your kid to eat anyway.
Yeah.
You know, Fruit Loops or whatever they might be. So I think, you know, obviously fresh fruits, vegetables, whole grains, those things are obviously going to be better, I think, for your health in general.
Yeah. So, the same kinds of the dietary guidelines has been recommended for all of us.
Exactly.
You would say the same sorts of things.
A lot of processed foods now.
Yeah. So, what about sugar? Again, just recently there seems it was a big article published in the New York Times magazine recently about some of the research that's being done on sugar and, you know, whether or not sugar is not just whether there's this potential that it could be a really bad thing, and that if you have a lot of sugar in your diet, and I guess really what we're thinking about is not so much naturally occurring sugars, because there's sugars in, you know, you eat an apple, it's got sugar in it, but more like processed sugar, like that you would get if you would consume a lot of soft drinks or if you ate a lot of candy bars or, you know,
it's
like
empty
that.
Calories. It's empty calories, so it displaces what you might want your child or what you might want to be eating. And it's, I used to have a soft drink here or there till my daughter came home from school one day and said, "Dad, do you know how many teaspoons of sugars are in that soft drink?" I go, "No." I did the calculations and it was like 12 or 13.
Yes.
I don't put sugar on anything. And so I'm off soft drink. So, you know, it's just an empty calorie. Also, there's some, you know, evidence that it's, you know, excess calories lead to obesity and yada, yada. And so I don't think there's anything new we're going to learn about sugar, not to mention the dental issues that exist. And I, you know, processed sugar is probably something to avoid if possible.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, other questions are welcome. If you want to send us an email, you can do that. WILL-talk@illinois.edu. You can also call us 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Well, here's a question that goes back to the allergy thing that we were talking about. Someone writes in by email and says, if one discovers a severe allergic reaction and doesn't have an EpiPen at hand, does administering Benadryl, assuming that it is available, help slow the reaction on the way to the emergency room?
For a anaphylactic reaction or a very acute reaction, a very serious reaction, you're not in good shape with Benadryl. I mean, that takes time to absorb. It would take time to act. And really, it's an antihistamine. What you need is something more potent. So would I not take it if that was my only choice? I would take it, but you better get to the ER quick.
All right.
Or call 911. I think one thing you don't want to do is in an emergency, jump in the car and drive 90 miles an hour. I think you call 911. Often people that arrive will have epinephrine or whatever you're in need of, including IV fluids or whatever it might be. So if you don't have an EpiPen and you have a severe food allergy, better talk to your doc. I would recommend having one on hand. And that's just a general rule now.
Okay. All right. Well, again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It's summertime. There are some things that we could do that just are the natural things that we always talk about when we come to this time of year. We are always encouraging adults, if they're going to be outside, to use sunscreen.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also now encouraging our kids. We want them to be active. We want them to be outside, running around.
Yes.
Well, we also need to be slathering the stuff on them,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Sunscreens, I think there are many choices. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to be real careful about making sure you have a product that screens for UVA and UVB, one burn ray, one skin cancer ray, UVA. And not all sunscreens had that in the past. Now most of them do. But if you look at the ingredients in them, they will rate the sunburn factor but may not rate the skin cancer preventing UVA factor. And there's a couple of, like, zinc oxide's great. Helioplex is great. And there's a couple of specific ingredients that you should look for in the sunscreens. Not to plug this, but the American Academy of Pediatrics has a great website now, healthychildren.org, healthychildren.org. You can find almost anything on there, including appropriate use of sunscreens, car seats, whatever it might be, age-related issues. You know, you can click on 2-month, 4-month, 6-month, and find information on your baby or your preschooler or toddler. So it's really a great website. It has good information. It has videos. It has text. It has references. And it's really what I'm trying to point people towards now for information.
Okay, good.
Healthychildren.org.
So that's the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Yes.
We receive no funding from the Academy, so I think it's okay we give them a little plug. Information resources are good, absolutely. And just, again, to go back to this point that you made, I think it's really important. You need to have screens that will screen for both these things, the A and the B rays. And I think that now people are used to the idea that there's a number on there.
Mm-hmm.
And that the higher the number it is, higher the number it is, the better it is.
The protect you.
Except that I think that what you say is true is that the number only applies to its ability to screen.
Burns.
That. The other one
is you don't burn. The rays that go deeper do not burn, but they change the cells in your skin, which damage them, which puts you at risk for the cancers.
So is there some chance they're going to change the information that's on the label so maybe tell you a little bit?
Yeah, they say UVA, UVB now.
Okay.
It should say UVA and UVB protection. But I don't know if they'll be able to rate that or not, and I'm not knowledgeable enough to know how to rate that.
Okay.
But one thing for sure. Now, they always say use SPF 15 or better, 30 or better. My recommendations are go as high as you can.
Mm-hmm.
There's two reasons. One is people don't put enough on so that you get better protection if you're going to be a light latherer. But two is put a lot on and reapply it. You probably should use about 2 ounces a visit, if you will. So 2 ounces would probably cover your body.
Yeah. And we've had occasionally visits here with dermatologists, and they say the way to think about it is, you know what a shot glass looks like?
Oh, yeah.
That's to...
I hope my kids don't know what a shot glass looks like.
Well, you and I know what it looks like. Yeah. A shot glass says, that's 2 ounces.
Yeah.
And think about how much it would take to fill a little glass like that. Well, that's a lot. And and as you say, most people are probably not putting on enough. Not near that much.
Not even close.
And maybe there are also parts that don't get the attention that they should, particularly things like your ears.
Yeah. So you're really bringing up a good point. So like hats with brims, clothing that protects you. Makes a product that you can really sunproof your clothing for about four or five
washes. You just
put
it into the wash and then it goes in there.
It helps. Don't buy a sunscreen insect repellent combination, please, because you need to put sunscreen on multiple times. Insect repellent, you probably shouldn't put on more than once if you're going to use insect repellent.
And that's particularly a concern with kids.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You know, I think they are recommending, I think DEET is the major ingredient in most of the good sunscreens. I know there are others. That's the most effective. If you're really insect sensitive, I think I would use that as long as you're a little older. I think they say kids over 2 months, even though I'm not comfortable with that. I think, certainly kids that are 8 to 10 months old and older, you can use those products. And, I think that's okay as long as you're staying under 30% DEET. I kind of recommend the 12 to 15%, which are the skintastics and things. Using netting if you have a baby, and over the stroller instead of the insect repellents might be a better choice. Avoiding buggy times of the day and buggy areas would also be helpful in washing off the sunscreen and the insect repellent when you get home.
Yeah,
and that helps.
Okay, very good. We have several callers here now. Let's talk with them. I'll take them in the order they came in, and that's 1, 2, 3, starting with line 1. In Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Hi. I have a question about allergies.
Sure.
I have a lot of food allergies, and up until recently, none of my 3 grown children had any food allergies, and suddenly my 24-year-old daughter developed an allergy to almost all fresh fruit. And I wonder, apples, cherries, cantaloupe, and it was quite sudden. I mean, she was eating an apple in Europe and suddenly became allergic, and now it's been all the fruit. So I'm wondering how common that is. And also, if you'd recommend, sensitivity shots for that, and if she should expect any more allergies to start coming out also.
What kind of reaction did she have again? Can you tell me?
She hasn't quit breathing, so her windpipe doesn't swell, but her lips swell, her tongue swells, itching, her eyes itch, her ears itch. So it's kind of a head allergy or a head reaction. but it doesn't affect the windpipe.
Not yet.
Hopefully and not. And it seems like it started with apples, then cherries. Recently she had, I think, a honeydew melon, and that did it. So it's kind of, it just seems all the fruits.
This would be a good topic for an allergist to discuss with her. Mm-hmm. There's some cross-reaction with certain foods.
Mm-hmm.
Pine nuts cross-react with this and that. Cantaloupe cross-reacts with this and that.
Hmm.
And if you have more than just a little tingling in your mouth and you have those symptoms, then, you know, you're at risk for, you know, having a major reaction, which might be more serious.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they can do specific testing to see what, you know, actually you're, you know, kind of document what you're dealing with, which would be helpful. And, you know, helping her prepare, you know, for the worst is always the way we're approaching this now.
Mm-hmm.
The testing can be done, skin testing or blood testing, they call it, RAS testing.
I think she actually started that, and they did the skin test for some non-foods, and she was so reactive they decided to go to the blood test for food.
Yeah, sounds like, adults can develop allergies. It's a strange thing. You can be exposed to something 50 times, and then the next time you react, including antibiotics and things. People always say, well, I've took that 4 times now, and the 5th time, you know, why? You know, well, it just, you need to be exposed. Something triggers an immune response with an allergy reaction. Nobody understands exactly why. And, you know, if you have a history of food allergies in the family, that puts you at risk, a little higher risk than the average population. So it's not surprising. I think I would make sure she's in the good hands of an allergist that can properly diagnose, help her avoid these foods, and prepare for the worst with whatever they think appropriate, whether it be epinephrine, you know, which is obviously something that people are really trying to promote more now. So, but some of the questions that you have, I don't know if you could, if you're interested in attending the sessions, but I know it says food allergy program. Usually it, you know, involves a lot of the kids' issues, but adults have big issues too. They may be able to answer some of your questions there. So.
Thanks very much.
Oh, and let me kind of one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no evidence right now that desensitization for food allergies is helpful. So,
Other
words, treatment's avoidance right now. They're looking at oral challenges in very small doses to see if you can develop tolerance, but the research has not really been completed, and it's not advisable right now.
Interesting. Okay, well, thanks very much.
All right, thanks.
Good luck.
So is it still, they have been doing this desensitization kind of thing with various kinds of plant allergies like pollen and stuff like
dogs
that.
Dogs and cats.
Dogs. So that apparently still, is it still the thought that that actually does work?
It does help.
Okay. But not with...
Well, right now, foods are not, that's not the way to go with foods. Foods, avoidance. Now, it's hard to avoid life. You know, you can't avoid pollen unless you're in a bubble. You can't hardly avoid dust mite around here and you try. I mean, for dust mite allergies, you do all the proper, you know, bedding, cover the mattresses, get rid of your carpet. But, you know, you can't obviously eliminate all of it. You treat it. And if things aren't going well, you do desensitization, which is the allergy shots. But for foods, it's avoidance right now. I don't know about in the future, but we'll see.
Okay.
Definitely don't do food challenges at home.
All right. Line 2, Champagne. Hello. Is there a caller there, line number 2 in Champagne? Okay. How about we'll go to Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
You were talking earlier about sunscreen and all the different numbers, you know, 30, 15, et cetera. But I had a question about people who are vitamin D deficient, people with darker complexion skin.
Yes.
Because I'm wondering if you use sunscreen, does that prevent you from getting the necessary amount of vitamin D?
You just started another topic. Thank you.
Okay.
yes, it does. Sunscreens block sun, which blocks the production of vitamin D. The sun actually activates a cholesterol type of chemical in the skin, which is converted to vitamin D through several steps. And yes, we're finding that, you know, maybe people are being better about sunscreening and things of this sort. And they've identified a percentage of the population that's vitamin D deficient for whatever reason. Maybe it's because you're dark-skinned. You don't get enough vitamin D in your diet. You're not getting outside as much. Now you're on video, you're doing video games or, you know, in here working. And so what's recommended now for the kids at least and for adults, as I recall, is a regular daily supplement of vitamin D because we're just not sure that people are really getting, you know, enough vitamin D. So, you know, the amount depends on, you know, what your lifestyle is like and what your diet is like. But typically, kids will be supplemented with 400 to 600 international units a day, at least that much on a regular basis.
Okay.
So,
okay, what does vitamin D actually help you do exactly? Just curious.
Well, the immediate effects are on bone metabolism. So, in other words, if you don't get enough calcium and vitamin D when you're young, you don't lay down the proper calcium in your bones so that later on your bones are more fragile, if you will. Osteoporosis is the kind of the term that's used.
Okay.
There's
right.
other things too, but those are some of that's the major impact on the body is calcium
right.
metabolism.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay,
you're welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I think that's probably a really important point, and I think also physicians who have counseled young girls, young women, that they should be getting lots and lots of calcium yep. as a way of reducing their potential for osteoporosis have also said you also need to make sure that you get plenty of vitamin D with
right.
your calcium
right.
and also that you have some weight-bearing
yes.
exercise, all of those things
yes.
to build earlier in life strongest bones that you mm-hmm. can so that if there is some bone loss later, you can deal with that.
Exactly, especially the spine and some other areas. But you mentioned a really good point, though. There's no magic pill for this. I think exercise, weight-bearing activity, critical. You can take all the vitamin D you want, all the calcium. If you sit around, your bones don't have any stress on them, so they're really not going to lay down the calcium. So I think it's all very important.
Yeah.
That's everybody wants a quick fix. Thank you, David.
Yeah, all right.
But
yeah.
It's real important.
And let's see. We'll talk with somebody in Champaign now, right now. Line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Yeah.
Yes.
Speaking about bones and calcium and vitamin D, how about comments on excesses of estrogen in commercial cow milk and the tendency that we seem to be having to be growing super tall people from having too much milk in their diet, cow's milk especially?
You know, I don't have a lot of information on the estrogens in the milk. I'm sure there's lots of things we're finding in commercially, you know, produced milk.
Well, especially since it's factory milk.
Yeah, I'm just not familiar with the data on that. I haven't seen good information on that, so I can't comment intelligently. The too much milk, I don't think it can lead to any increase in growth. And I've not seen any information to suggest that. Too much milk, cow's milk, I think is probably not healthy for you. I think a reasonable amount of cow's milk is healthy, but too much cow's milk leads to probably too much sodium, too much protein. Milk protein itself can irritate the gut if you are drinking this in excess. So I think reasonable portions of dairy products would be acceptable, but excess is not what we're yeah. really recommending. So.
I think there, you know, maybe the problem is that people think, well, the advice is that that we're supposed to be getting calcium in our diet.
Yeah.
So what do you think? Well, you think, well, that means dairy products. And there are other places you can get calcium. Maybe it's just not as packed
right.
as, you know, lean, greefy, green leafy vegetables.
Yeah. That's what kids call them.
Yeah, that's right. The green leafy vegetables, they have calcium, but I guess the deal is you have to eat an awful lot of them
yeah.
to get the same amount of calcium that you yeah. would if you drank a big glass of milk.
That's very true. Sources of calcium primarily are dairy, and I have to admit the plant calcium, if you will, is kind of tied up a little bit in oxalates, I think, and it's a little harder to absorb. But if you're in need, the body has the amazing ability to increase absorption if you're deficient. So, you know, you could probably get away without you know, cow's milk. But there are other sources, like you say. You can supplement your diet with calcium. There are calcium-fortified foods. Orange juice comes with the calcium, vitamin D supplement, if you will, is fortified for some of the products. And so there's ways of getting in the calcium. I mean, there's fortified soy, rice, milks. There's other ways of getting it in your diet, especially if you're milk allergic or milk intolerant.
Yeah. Okay. We're talking this morning with Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician. We're talking about children's health. We'd be very happy to take more questions. We'll continue to talk in just a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
White House Chief of Staff William Daley will deliver the address at this year's commencement of the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Hear what Daley has to say, as well as other highlights from the morning campus-wide ceremony Sunday afternoon at 2 on WILL AM 580. Watch commencement on cable channel UI7 or online at illinois.edu. And join us for highlights Sunday at 2 on AM 580.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. We're here weekday mornings, 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow morning, we'll talk with novelist Mary Doria Russell. She's trained as an anthropologist. She, in fact, went to school at University of Illinois as an undergraduate, has written some really good books. And her new book is a Western, and the central character in the book is Doc Holliday. And, of course, the Earps make an appearance in this book as well. Doc is what it's called, and we'll talk with her tomorrow morning. And then also tomorrow, we'll have another installment in this project we're calling The Deep Archives. This is something that we're doing to try to mark the 30th anniversary of the show. Focus has been on the air now 30 years, and we are going back into our archives to pull some shows that have not been heard in a very long time. They're not on our regular web archive. And so tomorrow we'll have two interviews for you. They're back in the 90s, and they're all about media and media ownership. Newt Minow, former chair of the FCC, the man who is famous for having described television as a vast wasteland. 50 years ago this week, he actually said that. And also Ben Bagdikian, who's a scholar who's written a lot about the concentration of ownership in media. These are interviews from the mid to late 90s, and you can hear them in edited versions tomorrow morning. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon. If you'd like to see what we're doing in the weeks and days ahead or listen to past programs, go to our website, will.illinois.edu. And the guest in this hour Focus is Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician from Carl in Urbana. And we're talking about children's health and... You got questions? Anything we've talked about?
We've talked about TV before, and I think, you know, I would say that there's a lot of TV that really kids shouldn't be exposed to, and I think parents should be very careful about what their kids are watching on the tube and what they're doing on the internet. So that's been well shown in multiple studies, and I would highly recommend being actively involved in your kids' viewing habits.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, you know, going back to this, one of these interviews was back from the mid-90s. And at that time, there was a big issue concerning something called the V-chip.
Yeah.
You remember?
Oh, yeah.
You know,
sure.
It seemed actually to be some controversy about it. Now I think the idea, every television comes with something like that. It's just built in.
It's built in.
It's just built in. And I don't know anybody thinks that that's particularly exceptional or newsworthy, but it seems at the time there was a lot of debate about whether or not that was a good thing or not.
Well, I think it makes life a little easier at home, but it's not foolproof. Kids have ways of working around things, especially on computers,
yes.
And I have no idea what they're doing.
They're probably much smarter than the parents, unless their parents happen to be software engineers.
Right. Yeah. So, you can't take anything for granted.
I do remember now, maybe this has been some years, I thought that was at one point where, in fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics said something about how they didn't recommend that children under two watch television at all?
Yeah. There's a couple of things. I think, you know, they first of all, the screen time, they've always recommended some kind of limit. Well, that makes good sense. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be watching TV for 12 hours a day or on, you know, the computer. I think you need to get out and play and be active and interact and use your imagination. And there's a lot of, you know, kind of dead time on TV where your brain's just kind of, you know, kind of not functioning, if you will. And you know, in addition to the exposure to some of the things, I really think media has a really significant impact on young women, whether it be TV, movies, or magazines. It really does impact how young women see themselves. And I think that is a significant concern for me And then, you know, kids are exposed to all sorts of violence, and they've shown that that does impact behavior, you know, aggressive behavior. There's some question now about kids that are really dealing with rapidly changing, you know, viewing rapidly changing events, that it might actually affect their attention span to some degree as they develop. And, we don't know for sure. But I think overall, I think very little benefit in a kid under two watching TV other than to entertain them so you can go do something else.
Yeah.
Which is probably not the best way to entertain your kid. So.
You know, just that's interesting, because just recently I recall coming across an article about spending a lot of time in front of a screen and ADHD, in the sense that there are people who apparently their children are being diagnosed with ADHD, and they say something like, but they have this idea that ADHD means that you can't focus on any one thing for very long. And but they say, but my kid can spend an hour, a couple of hours looking at the computer screen.
Sure.
And they seem to be surprised that both of those things could be the case. And what this article said was that, in fact, that was not surprising at all that those two things should go together.
Yeah, that's correct. Take someone with ADHD, if they are dealing with a subject that's highly interesting to them, or a subject or a task that's very interactive, if you will, that it's constantly changing, then they do fine with those kind of activities. The screen can be constantly changing, and you can, with computers, there's all sorts of games you can play. They can play on a video game for hours on end because it's constantly changing and they're interacting and it's keeping their attention. But stick the homework assignment up on the screen, and you know they'll be back to, this is boring. I'm not really, my central focusing area of the brain, my prefrontal cortex, is not activated. I'm basically losing interest, and therefore, you know, I get off task. But it's very, very common to hear that, you know. But no surprise.
Now, then people go from that and they say, all right, so does that mean that if my child spends all kinds of time with the computer playing computer games, that they're going to develop ADHD?
Well,
does that promote ADHD?
Doesn't follow.
Doesn't.
But they're looking at early exposure to those type of media, if you will. They're looking at it. I don't know whether they'll ever really be able to draw a conclusion that is or isn't at least additive. But I think ADHD is primarily, I wouldn't say primarily, but generally a genetic disorder, if you will, like other disorders. And I think you have the genes, if you will, and maybe exposure to environmental factors does influence you developing the actual disorder. We'll find out, I think, over time. But it's definitely, I don't think watching TV or playing video games creates, or produces ADHD. No.
Okay. Let's take a call here. Someone in Indiana, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. As a quick footnote on that thing about kids getting around things, we've learned in the family, best way to do it is just pull it out of the wall.
Yes.
Let it go at that.
Or yes.
Kind of a timing device that's well-constructed and, you know, locked proof and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to ask is something, most of the time when I listen to you, I spread the information to the younger members of the family who are at age where they may decide to have a child or two, so I get early warning kind of things. But since there's sort of a slowness here, I thought I'd just ask you something I was taught when I was a young boy, that if the child walked early, it would talk late, or if it talked early, it would walk late. And I was wondering if there's anything to that and if you knew anything about it.
Actually, that doesn't seem to hold true, even though there'll be some kids that are, you know, fall into that category. The development's so varied. Kids can start walking at 8 months or start walking 16 months and still be totally normal within that normal range. They have found, this is interesting that you brought this up, they found that kids that are in walkers and exercisers and the devices that put those infants up in a standing position, it does affect their development. Premature babies actually end up having delays in their motor development, their walking and crawling. And then non-preemies actually have a little more trouble with cognitive development at 2 years of age. And it's a one or two studies, but I kind of recommend that people not really use those devices much in the first year of life, that they need to get down and crawl and they need to get down and roll and they need to work on things that they should be working on instead of being upright, scooting around in little devices, if you will.
Yeah.
So that's my
recommendation. That's a good one. That's one I'll pass on for sure because it's important because there's so much pressure now on young families to, do everything at one time. So if you put the child in one of those things like that, I remember them as sort of having a net kind of situation and they would sit and could touch the floor and move themselves. It's almost like a, an arcade, bing, 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 bing.
Yeah, exactly.
And I remember, laughing about it, and can't really remember if the kid who was, in any way abnormal came up. I don't think so.
Yeah.
That's something I'll pass on to the women for sure. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. The other problem with the walkers, the major problem was that in Canada they're outlawed basically because of the deaths and injuries from these walker devices. Kids would scoot on down the stairs, basement stairs were a major risk for infants and walkers. And so, I think it's not a good idea, personally.
Okay. And just I'm sure we've talked about this and when you have other doctors here talking about children and their development, there are general sorts of things about general benchmarks. By this point, child should be doing this. By this point, child should be doing that. But they're just really general, and from one child to another, there's huge variability.
Right, especially in the same family, which is interesting because when you see one child that's much different from the other child, you have to ask, is there something wrong? And it does take some time to sort that out sometimes, and you have to kind of follow kids along in a linear fashion. If I see somebody one time and they ask me, is this normal? I don't know. Let me see. What did you do before? What are you going to be doing next? And so progression is really important in development, making progress. If you get hung up at a level of development, that's really when there's a concern, or more importantly, when you regress, when you go backwards. That's not normal.
We are coming down to about our last 6-7 minutes. Somebody out there's got a question. Give us a call, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455.
I have one more plug.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes.
Okay, so we didn't talk much about summer safety.
Yes.
Okay, and there's like bike safety. There's issues related to swimming, drownings, all sorts of things. But on June 4th, Playing It Safe, it's an event for the family and kids at the fairgrounds in Urbana, just adjacent to the Carle Hospital. And we're going to have all sorts of people there to help you out and to promote injury prevention, basically. We'll have fire department, police department, natural resources, Safe Kids. I'm going to be there doing car seat checks. And so I would highly recommend June 4th. Get on out there. I think it starts at 10:30 in the morning, goes till early afternoon. We have prizes, food, you name it. So it is a fun event. If you haven't done it, check it out. It's free. So June 4th, Playing It Safe. You'll hopefully see something in the paper pretty soon about that. Car seat recommendations?
Yeah. And actually, it's a good thing you mentioned that It seems to me that recently there has been some confusing stuff about, where is it supposed to be? Is it supposed to face forward? Are they supposed to face backwards?
You read too much. Yes.
Isn't that the truth?
You do. Yes, car seats. Now, the recommendation for infant car seats is to keep them actually rear-facing even until the age of two. So actually toddlers should be rear-facing in their car seats until the age of two. A little tricky. You got to learn. You've got to get the right car seat. It's got to fit comfortably in your car. Those car seat checks are going to do. Bring your car seat. Bring your kid. Bring your car. We'll work on it with you at the car seat event at Playing It Safe. Also, we have technicians in town that can help. But rear-facing till two. So it's kind of tricky. A little crowded, no problem. Kids can bend their legs rear-facing. After that, it's much better to be in a car seat with a 5-point harness till you outgrow the car seat. So if you're four, no magic. Don't go to a booster if you've got a great car seat. That would be like a race car driver wearing a seatbelt. Makes no sense. They're really strapped in. They're good. So stay in a car seat as long as you can. And some of them go up to 80 pounds now. They get to social issues with the kids. Why am I in a car seat and my other kids are driving? But whatever you can do to keep them in their car seats a little longer would be helpful, much better off in an accident. And use the back seat. Don't put kids in the front seat. Airbags, all sorts of things go on in the front seat.
So. Okay. It seems to me that more and more, if people are lucky enough to buy more recent cars, I think probably more and more cars are actually set up for car seats, and they have various ways specifically for you to get the thing strapped in there, and you don't have to try to
maneuver the belt around.
Yeah, figure out how exactly we're going to do this to get the seat in there.
And I forgot which year the cars were required to have some appropriate devices that the car seat snaps into, but it's much easier. Much easier.
Well, it's been warm enough so that the kids have been out and active. I mean, they're not just going to, not just like suddenly it's gotten warm, so they're going to be out and doing stuff. But I'm sure that people are now almost year-round ride bikes.
Yeah.
We had Bike to Work Day where actually we were really encouraging, people, that grown-ups to do that. But you also want to encourage people to ride safely.
Yeah.
You want to talk about the helmet wearing battle for parents?
Well, I would like to talk about texting and being on the phone when you're in the car, please. Distraction is really the key. A lot of drivers are really distracted drivers, so please pull over if you have to text someone. Wait till you get home, because that's a big problem, not just for bicyclists but for other pedestrians and other people driving. But for kids, there's a lot of things you can do to promote safety. The first thing is when you get the bike out, make sure the brakes are working, the chain's on good, and tires are in good shape, because I've seen some problems there, which are not really something you would want to see, with chains falling off or brakes not working and causing accidents. Proper fitting bikes, so don't buy one that they have to grow into over 4 years. Get the right size bike, and they should be able to stand up and not have to be resting on the top of the bicycle, if you will, uncomfortably. They should be able to stand with both feet on the ground, straddling the bike comfortably. And obviously wearing helmets prevents the really major injuries, which are head injuries. And if parents wear the helmet, that helps, right?
Yeah.
Enforce the helmet rule and make sure it's properly fitting. We do helmet fitting at Play It Safe, by the way. We have some pretty cheap helmets there for people that are looking to get a helmet. Proper clothing, bright clothing. I ride a bike, so I wear this fluorescent yellow because I want to make sure people see me. I don't ride at dusk. There's some things you can do that are common sense, and knowing where your kids ride. About half the serious injuries happen just in the neighborhood, believe it or not, or on a side street, not on a major highway. And it's usually car versus kid, or kid not watching where they're going. So that's pretty important, too. So, I think everybody has to do their job. Same thing with inline skating and skateboards. But, it's hard to get kids to abide by rules, but if you start early, it helps. Helps if the neighborhood kids do the same thing. So get parents together, band together, and it would really be helpful. If we had a law, but it's really a difficult topic right now. So
Well, I think talk about distracted drivers. I think that we really anybody who drives around the university community know we also have an issue with distracted pedestrians.
Oh yes,
and people people texting while they're walking down the street.
Yep, that's right.
And I guess another thing that you got to talk to your kids about. When you're walking down the street, you got listening to your iPod.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're looking at your phone. You're doing texting. Please, you've got to pay attention to what's going on around you. When you come to cross the street at any point, you've got to be aware of your surroundings.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
One more caller here in McLean County, line one. Hello.
Good morning. There was a mention about the helmets on kids. When my children were growing up, I always kept helmets on them. Now I'm facing the problem of my daughter not requiring helmets of her two daughters. And I was wondering if there was any resource, any strategies for approaching either the children or my daughter. Probably the children would be more effective. And pointing out the dangers so that they would be more willing to wear helmets or any other thing that would make them more willing to wear helmets when their mother doesn't make them.
How old are the kids?
5 and 9.
Okay. Well, if you go to safekids.org, or go to healthychildren.org. They have actually a little area on how to get your kids to wear helmets, how to encourage them. But it starts with the parents. So that's a big problem. It really has to start with the parents. I mean, you can buy the kids fancy helmets. You can give your daughter data. There's a ton of data on head injuries and helmets and how it prevents 85% of the serious injuries. Talking to other parents that have had kids that were injured, I mean, those kind of things are certainly helpful. But unfortunately, you know, the parents in charge and their pediatrician hopefully can talk to them a little bit, or their family doctor. I spend a little bit of time during each visit. I have helmets in my office that are just totally cracked up and ugly from injuries and from falls, and how those helmets have saved those lives. And I think it makes a difference. So everybody has to contribute, I think, to that. Good luck. I hope you can work that out.
All right. Thank you for the call. Well, I guess we're just about the point we have to finish up here. We had a list of things you wanted to talk about. We've talked about the events, but we can do that again. If people are interested in a lot of good information on food allergies.
Food allergies.
We've got a program going tomorrow. This is the 13th at the Forum at Carl in Urbana, starting at 4:30 in the afternoon.
Yes, sir.
So you would encourage people, though, to try to pre-register for this?
If they can. I guess you can just show up, but I think they're trying to plan a little food and things like that. But just show up. They're going to kill me. Just show up, because the speaker is outstanding. She knows more about food allergies than any person I've ever talked to. She works with probably the best food allergy program in the country. So I would go if you have food allergies or interested in the topic.
All right. So that's tomorrow. And then the general safety program, Playing It Safe, that's on June 4th at the Urbana Fairgrounds. Is that a weekend day?
It's a Saturday.
Saturday.
Yeah, it's great. Hopefully it won't rain.
Okay.
Seems to want to rain on that day.
And no last things that you want to
No, I think you covered it all. You wore me out.
Yeah, so. Wear your sunscreen and wear your bike helmet and watch out for the insect repellent.
Take your vitamin D.
Take your vitamin D. And
exercise.
Look both ways when you cross the street.
And don't iPod or text or whatever you're driving. So.
We're done hanging now for now. Dr. Malcolm Hill, he's pediatrician at Carl in Urbana. Hey, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. Thank you.